You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Teresa Kotsarilis, filling in for Philip Yun. So something historic just happened, right?
It's time for our better angels to prevail. Tonight, the whole world is watching America. And I believe at our best, America's a beacon for the globe.
Joe Biden became the first presidential candidate to unseat an incumbent in almost 30 years. He received more votes than any other presidential candidate in U.S. history. And his vice president, Kamala Harris, will be the first woman, the first Black American, and the first Asian American to ever hold that office.
But while I may be the first woman in this office, I will not be the last.
As of this recording, world leaders have congratulated President-elect Biden on his decisive victory. He's launched his own coronavirus task force, announced his chief of staff, but President Trump will not concede. Instead, Trump's campaign is filing a flurry of lawsuits in swing states, alleging election fraud without evidence. His administration isn't giving Biden classified intelligence briefings. And at the same time, Trump's cleaning house at the Pentagon. He's replacing top civilian officials with people who are loyal to him. It's hard to know what this shakeup could mean. Experts worry about a major U.S. foreign policy decision. Is Trump planning to pull troops out of Afghanistan, for instance, or possibly making a move against Iran? He did make those campaign promises. Experts are confident that Trump will eventually leave office. But this messy transition is unsettling, right? We have a president who won't concede, he's shaking up the military, and top leaders in the Republican Party are going along with it.
President Trump is 100% within his rights to look into allegations of irregularities and weigh his legal options.
The president should fight hard. I think you're going to see real evidence of systematic voting irregularities.
As of tonight, tens of millions of Americans suspect this election was stolen from them.
So this week, we're looking ahead at the Biden administration's many foreign policy challenges, which Trump's military shakeup could make even harder. But first, we look at Democratic backsliding at home and abroad, and at the leaders who enable it.
Authoritarian populists need people who can sell their ideas, who can help them find a way to reach people. Because in order to prepare people to accept this kind of leader, you need to create a mythology around him.
Anne Applebaum is a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and a staff writer at The Atlantic. And she's not surprised that right-wing intellectuals and political strategists are so loyal to Trump. She's known some of these people personally for years. Some of them used to be her friends. Back in the 90s, Applebaum's social circle was global, cosmopolitan, and conservative. She was in touch with center-right politicians and media elites throughout the U.S. and Europe.
Whether it was the Thatcherites in Britain or Reaganites in the United States, it felt very much like this was a fraternity of people who felt the same way about the world.
Applebaum splits her time between the U.S. and Poland, where her husband was a center-right politician. She says the 90s were a heady, optimistic time. Communism had just fallen, Western democracy and free market capitalism seemed to be ascendant. In 1999, she and her husband threw a millennial New Year's Eve party at their home in the Polish countryside.
And the guests were people from his work. He was then a deputy foreign minister in a center-right Polish government. A lot of them were journalists. And they came roughly from a milieu that in Poland is called prawica, or the right, you know, the anti-communists, the people who'd fought with the Solidarity movement against totalitarian dictatorship.
Some of Applebaum's journalist friends from London and Moscow were there, too, along with conservative friends from New York.
It was a fairly scruffy party. You know, people slept on the floor in the basement, basically, because there weren't enough hotel rooms. There was no catering.
There was no such thing as catering in post-communist Poland.
And so the food at this party was beef stew I made with my mother-in-law.
People stayed up all night dancing to Pink Floyd.
The good feeling of the party came from this sense of, you know, it's the millennial, it's New Year's Eve, and you know, we won this big argument, and we in our country are going forward to something better. We're looking forward to great things that we were going to all do together in the future.
Fast forward to 2020, Applebaum's former party guests aren't exactly working together on anything.
People don't speak to each other anymore. There are people who I used to see a lot and would have lunch with or would go to their houses. I don't see anymore.
Applebaum's most recent book is called Twilight of Democracy, The Seductive Lure of Authoritarianism.
My book really is the result of me realizing a couple of years ago that a lot of the people who I knew in Poland mostly, but also in other parts of Europe and in the United States, had become something closer to the radical right. And the book is an attempt to explain why that happened.
Poland's right wing started to really seize power in 2015, when the Law and Justice Party won an overall majority in parliament.
Populist, Eurosceptic, and firmly right wing. The Law and Justice Party's decisive win in Poland's election.
The party attracted voters who'd felt left behind by Poland's economic growth in the decades since communism fell. It offered higher childcare benefits, increased pension payments, and was staunchly anti-immigrant.
It's a party that identifies itself as the only truly patriotic political grouping in Poland. It offers its members not just a set of politics, but a kind of identity. We're the true Poles. And everybody else is our enemies, foreigners, traitors, elites, people who don't deserve to rule. We sometimes call this kind of politics populist. More accurately, you could call it populist authoritarian, because once a political grouping believes that it alone has the right to rule, then it also grants itself the permission to break the rules. So once the Law and Justice Party won an election in 2015, and they won it perfectly legally, when they came to power, they began to break the rules. They packed the Polish court system. They took over public media, made it a kind of very extreme and very radical form of party political media. They purged the civil service, seeking to replace, in some cases, people who had neutral qualifications with loyalists. So their goal was to create a kind of one-party state. They seek to replace the Polish political system with the one-party system in which they will dominate.
The party also closely allied itself with Poland's Catholic Church,
which functions, I'm very sorry to say this, as their ideological wing. The Polish Catholic Church has a very long and illustrious history. It played an extraordinary role during both the Second World War and during the communist era in Poland. Till 10 years ago, it functioned as a truly national institution in Poland, something that everybody felt some sympathy for, even if they weren't religious. But unfortunately, over the last decade, it has transformed itself into a kind of wing of the Law and Justice Party. One of the party's arguments for itself is that we are the party of the church. So if you are Catholic, you should vote for us. And of course, if you're not Catholic and you don't vote for us, then you're not really Polish and you're not moral and you're not part of the political community. What they are often very good at is dividing people and finding the wedge issues or the hot button issues that make people really upset. In Poland, the issue in the most recent presidential election was homosexuality.
The LGBTQ community in Poland has a message for the world: we don't feel safe here.
As a mob of right-wing Poles attacked a pride march in the town of Białystok, one of several districts that have declared themselves to be LGBT-free.
The president campaigned on the idea that homosexuality was a foreign ideology that was being brought into Poland and that anybody who wanted to defend their family needed to fight against it. You know, he was using the expression LGBT, which actually is meaningless in Polish. And for people who understood that there was this foreign idea that was coming to attack their families, it was very upsetting. And people came out to vote, I think, probably just especially to stop that.
The Law and Justice Party can also be virulently xenophobic and embraces a range of conspiracy theories. And if any of these political strategies are ringing a bell for you, that's not surprising. As the Law and Justice Party consolidated power in Poland, authoritarian populists in the UK, Brazil, and the US started winning elections of their own. As I was reading up on the Law and Justice Party's, you know, the methods they use to consolidate power, and as you were just walking through them, I gotta say, as an American, this sounds pretty familiar. Is there an actual playbook that certain authoritarian populist governments are following, or are we talking about multiple instances in which authoritarian populist governments have stumbled upon the same tactics and they happen to work in multiple places?
Yes, there is an actual authoritarian populist playbook. And funny enough, it works both for right-wing authoritarians and for left-wing authoritarians. And the playbook is take power, and once in power, undermine all of the neutral institutions that can preserve the possibility of democracy. So again, it's very often begins with an assault on the courts, make the judiciary dependent on the ruling party. It's very often involves an assault on the media. In Poland, it was an assault directly on the state media, which they were able to take over. But in the United States and other places, you very often see populist leaders attacking the credibility of the media, which they do so that the media can't hold them to account. Very often involves attacking civil servants, attacking bureaucrats. You know, and these are what authoritarian populism does, is it undermines these basic assumptions without which democracy is impossible. These are tactics that anybody who understands power know that these are things that you need to do if you want to avoid being held to account, if you want to change the composition of the government or of the state, and if you want to make sure that you win re-election without being challenged. I mean, you're trying to change the system so that it's impossible for your opponents to win, and that is the point of it. Now, if you look at what Hugo Chavez did in Venezuela, if you look at what Erdogan has done in Turkey, you see very similar patterns in each one of these cases. But the intuitive understanding that what you need to do is undermine the neutral institutions of the state is something that they all share.
Applebaum thought that she and her friends shared some of the same fundamental values. But today, a number of her New Year's Eve guests support Poland's ruling party, like the godmother of one of Applebaum's children. She regularly hosts the head of the Law and Justice Party at her apartment now, and she and Applebaum haven't spoken in years. Another party guest became a Holocaust denier, embraced all kinds of conspiracy theories.
A real turning point for me was the moment when the Law and Justice Party, or rather the television station that they control, attacked me. To be clear, I'm married to a Polish politician. I'm a journalist living in Poland. You know, in some ways, I've always been a figure of interest in Poland. But in 2015, after they won the election, they began to get some bad press. And this group of journalists got it into their heads that the person who was responsible for all of this bad press was me, and that I was secretly coordinating it as an enemy of Poland. It was, you know, very hurtful to be accused of doing this, but it was also absurd. That's not how the media works. I am not able to coordinate, you know, all of the world's journalism and what it writes about Poland. It actually was an excellent reflection of their conspiratorial mindset. This is how they see the world. And I was on the cover of several Polish magazines. I was featured on Polish state television in the news programs as a kind of enemy of Poland. And it was very peculiar and strange.
The most unsettling part of all of this, Applebaum knew some of the people who were attacking her personally.
People who were at my party or people who I knew from the early 1990s do work in the state media. People who I know were responsible for this campaign, yes. Now there's really very little that they could say about me that would bother me.
Applebaum says that journalists and academics have spent plenty of time analyzing authoritarian leaders and the ordinary people who follow them. But she says they've spent less time analyzing people like her former friends.
The intellectuals, the journalists, the political strategists, the people who will help the populist explain himself and sell himself.
Applebaum says they play an essential role in authoritarian regimes. And in her book, she takes the time to really define and study them.
I use the term clerks partly because there isn't another good word in English to describe the class of people who I'm talking about. Intelligentsia sounds somehow Russian, and intellectuals sounds somehow upper West Side. And the word clerks or clerks comes from a French writer called Julien Benda, who wrote a book that was published in the 1920s about the role of intellectuals in the extremist politics of his time, both the far right and the far left. And he was talking about conservative intellectuals who gradually moved from being intellectuals, from being people who wrote about history, who wrote about philosophy, into the realm of politics, and used their gift for language and words to help these extremist politics rise to power. And I use the word simply to describe that class of people, you know, intelligent, educated, you could even say elite people, very often well-traveled and well-read, who then agree to cooperate with a populist leader or a populist authoritarian leader to help him win power. And the question is, you know, who are they and why do they do it?
So what's in it for them? I mean, why do they do it?
There's a wide range of motivations. The one thing that I would say does unite them is usually a sense of very profound disappointment. These are people who are disappointed with the societies that they live in. Sometimes they're disappointed with their own careers or with their own role in the society, but usually something about present moment disgusts them or angers them. You know, our nation isn't as great as it used to be. Our morals are declining. We are changing in ways that are making us, you know, we won't recognize who we are. We're losing something essential. Very often they are distressed or angered by rapid modernization. And to be clear, rapid change, so whether it's economic change or whether it's political change, does mean that things are lost. You know, ways of life that people had or things they enjoyed 20 or 30 or 40 years ago are gone. What the intellectuals and the propagandists and strategists of the far right have often been very good at is finding those things that people miss and creating a sense of nostalgia for a different time, and attaching that sense of nostalgia to, you know, to a political leader, and offering that as a political program.
And they also attach to this sense of unfairness. Right. I mean, you talk very eloquently in your book about this kind of disillusionment following the reforms implemented in Poland after the fall of communism and how people kind of began characterizing that competitive system as unfair.
One of the other things that unites some of the people in my book is that they've come to despise the ideal of competitiveness. So they see all around them who's winning in our society. So it's the businessmen who win in the free markets. It's the politicians who win in these competitive elections. It's the, you know, the clever people who can pass exams, who do well at, you know, in universities and in the government and in the civil service. And this, to some of them, seems wrong because many of these people don't fit their definition of what, you know, a good Pole should be. So they aren't Catholic or they're not religious or they're not patriotic. They don't use the same kind of patriotic language that the law and justice core intellectuals believe should be used. And one of their major projects is to replace those people. So we don't want people who can pass exams. We want people who are loyal to us. We don't want people running businesses who are good at running businesses. We want people who will donate money to our party and who will be, again, loyal to us or who speak about Poland in the way that we want them to speak. And so they have orchestrated a kind of assault on all kinds of institutions, but in particular on the leadership of institutions. And they've sought to replace leaders with, again, with people who are loyal to them.
Of course, Applebaum hasn't just watched this pattern play out in Poland. She's seen it here, too. Plenty of people from her conservative social circle in the U.S. have joined the far right. And their tactics follow the authoritarian populist playbook that Applebaum's described. They've attacked the judiciary, assaulted the quote-unquote mainstream media, and scapegoated minorities to drum up support. In Twilight of Democracy, Applebaum writes specifically about Laura Ingraham, who she knew peripherally in the 1990s. Back then, she described Ingraham as an idealistic Reaganite. Today, well, you probably know her from Fox News.
Our nation is under attack. There's no other way to describe what's going on right now. A lot of very clever people who've gone to lots of fancy schools will someday be very sorry that when the time came for them to speak for America, They were nowhere to be found.
One of Ingram's mentors was Pat Buchanan, who worked in the Reagan White House. The Anti-Defamation League characterizes his beliefs as white supremacist. He's denied the Holocaust and is vehemently anti-immigrant. Buchanan's also made several guest appearances on Ingram's show. Was the xenophobia that you see in her career and in the career of some of these people who started in the center right and were Reaganites or Thatcherites or what have you, and then they shifted to the right, is the xenophobia you can now see them openly embracing, was that always there? I mean, we talk about Reaganism in the U.S., and Reagan, you know, it's been well documented now that modern Republican Party was built upon the Southern strategy and dog whistling around states' rights issues. So to what degree is this something that was always there and has just come to the surface now?
So the Republican Party was always a coalition, and there were different kinds of people in it, and they were part of it for different reasons. You can find the whole story of the Southern strategy. You can also find different things. So, for example, George W. Bush, one of his big political ideas was that he was going to bring more Hispanics into the Republican Party. And when he first won office, that was one of his main goals, was to do immigration reform. That was all then sidelined and sidetracked by 9/11, and then that changed the immigration story permanently. I would not say before Trump, actually, that you could ever have characterized the entire Republican Party or the entire conservative movement as solely a white supremacist or a racist movement. It simply wasn't. But can you find those elements in it 20 and 30 years ago? Yes, absolutely.
Today, both of the countries Applebaum calls home are increasingly polarized. In Poland, the Law and Justice Party's presidential candidate, Andrzej Duda, narrowly won re-election earlier this year. Now, hundreds of thousands of people are taking to the streets to protest a court ruling that would almost completely ban abortions in Poland. These are the largest protests Poland's experienced since the collapse of communism in 1989, and the Law and Justice Party has delayed implementing the court ruling. In the U.S., of course, things are even more tenuous. From rank-and-file voters to members of his administration, plenty of Trump supporters still think he won this election. And Applebaum says she doesn't think Trump will ever concede.
One of the strange things about this election is how very precisely it has followed the pattern that you could have predicted from listening to Donald Trump over the last couple of months. He's been telling us for months that the election will be rigged, that it won't be fair. He's implied that, you know, whenever, you know, if late votes are coming in, we're going to get rid of that vote. They're going to get rid of the votes. He said that a few weeks ago. And almost everything he said on the evening of the election and on the following day was followed exactly that pattern. So if there was something surprising, it was that he really did exactly what he said he was going to do. I mean, very often, you know, people don't believe Trump because what he says seems so extreme and crazy. But actually, on election day, he followed through very methodically. As results came in that were not favorable to him, he immediately began spinning. You know, it's not fair, it's cheating, you know, these aren't real votes. You know, he got his campaign staff to start denouncing the results. He's launched legal challenges in Pennsylvania and elsewhere. All of this was exactly in character. I mean, almost, you know, it was almost like a parody of what you would have thought Donald Trump would have done.
She says he's following a carefully planned strategy to mobilize his political base by discrediting democratic systems. This is a man who's deeply in debt, in the crosshairs of multiple lawsuits. He needs this support more than ever right now. One of my takeaways, at least, from the election thus far is that we are going to have to cope and deal with Trumpism for quite a long time. And I'm wondering if you have any insights into the best or most effective ways to do that. You know, you've written that given the right conditions, any society can turn against democracy. After reading your book, it seems that democracy, it's a delicate thing. And I'm wondering how you are planning to go into the next 4 years as we continue to try to handle this ideology, which can be quite dangerous to democracy.
Very often, counterintuitively, the best ways to push back against populist authoritarianism are not to answer it directly. In other words, not to get dragged into the culture wars that they want to launch. The best way to fight against this is very often not to use the parallel language back. You know, don't fight his extremism with more anger or with the opposite point of view. Very often the best way to fight it is to change the subject. And so rather than talking about existential issues, matters of life and death and deep morality, get them to talk about, I don't know, how we fix the roads together. And that is easier said than done. But as much as you can, finding ways to have productive conversations, to have rational conversations, to have fact-based conversations about things that people care about but which are not so existential, this is probably the best way to fight it. Look, anybody who's ever designed a democratic system, and that includes the founders of the United States, always knew that democracy was fragile. Democracy requires of people something that's really almost incredible. Namely, it requires you, when you win an election, to keep in place all of the instruments that will allow your political enemies to beat you again in 4 years. I mean, anybody who reads the history of democracy knows that most democracies have failed. You know, Hamilton and Madison, while they were writing the Federalist Papers, were reading the histories of Greece and Rome to try and understand how those democracies had failed. Our confidence that there was nothing that could ever happen to our democracy was really overplaced. I mean, we became conceited in a way and, you know, convinced that nothing in our country could ever go wrong.
Applebaum is a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and journalist. Her most recent book is Twilight of Democracy: The Seductive Lure of Authoritarianism. You've been listening to World Affairs. World Affairs is produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from Chevron, First Republic Bank, Denton's Asset Management Company, and Jonathan and Marit Visbal. This episode was produced by Joanne Jennings and Jared Sport. Temba Daniels provided research assistance. Our music is by Blue Dot Sessions. Tatum Sanderbeck is our digital producer. Our technical advisor is Jim Bennett, and our CEO is Philip Young. I'm Teresa Katsourilis. Thanks for listening.